Hello, and welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Rosemary Onkwe, bringing you readings from the following publications: Voice Health News, The Beacon, Kansas City, Blavity, The Griot, News One, and Anscape. Today we'll begin our readings with an article from The Voice titled, How Your Apple Watch Could Warn You About High Blood Pressure, written by The Voice Health News, September 15, 2025. Key takeaways. Apple Watch can now alert users to possible high blood pressure. Alerts use 30-day heart data, not exact cuff reads. FDA approval clears global rollout to 150-plus countries. Apple is once again expanding the role of its smartwatch in healthcare. Beginning this month, millions of Apple Watch owners around the world will gain access to a groundbreaking feature, FDA-cleared hypertension alerts. The update, included with the release of Watch OS 26, allows certain models of the Apple Watch to screen for signs of chronic high blood pressure, often called the silent killer. Why hypertension matters. Hypertension, or high blood pressure, occurs when the force of blood against artery walls is consistently too high. Left untreated, it can lead to serious health problems such as heart attacks, strokes, and kidney disease. The World Health Organization estimates that 1.3 billion adults worldwide live with hypertension, and nearly half don't know they have it because symptoms rarely show up until complications occur. In the United States, nearly one in two adults are affected, making early detection a pressing public health challenge. Apple believes its new alerts could notify over 1 million people in the first year alone who may be living with undiagnosed hypertension. How the alerts work. The Apple Watch doesn't replace a blood pressure cuff, nor does it give exact systolic or diastolic readings. Instead, it uses its optical heart sensor to measure blood volume changes through the skin, a technique known as photoplethysmography, photoplethysmography, PPG. Over time, the watch passively collects this data while filtering for moments when the user is sitting still. The machine learning algorithm then reviews the readings in 60-second segments, compiling data over a rolling 30-day period. If it detects consistent patterns that suggest hypertension, the watch issues a discrete alert. Users are then advised to 1. Record their blood pressure for 7 days using a standard cuff. 2. Share those results with a healthcare provider. This process aligns with guidelines from the American Heart Association, ensuring the watch is used as a screening tool rather than a diagnostic device, backed by research and FDA clearance. Apple's hypertension detection system isn't arriving overnight. It was developed using data from more than 100,000 participants across multiple studies and validated in a clinical trial of over 2,000 people. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration cleared the feature on September 11, 2025, confirming its safety and reliability. Unlike competitors who faced pushback for launching unapproved health features, Apple pursued FDA review early, helping to build trust among healthcare professionals and users alike. Who can use it? The feature will be available on Apple Watch Series 9, Series 10, and the new Series 11, Apple Watch Ultra 2, and the new Ultra 3. These devices must be running Watch OS 26, which rolls out September 15th for existing models. The Series 11 and Ultra 3 will ship the feature enabled starting September 19th. The alerts will launch in over 150 countries, including US and Europe, though some regions may require additional regulatory clearance. There are some exclusions. The alerts are not intended for people under 22, individuals who are pregnant, or anyone already diagnosed with hypertension. Benefits for everyday users. Benefits for everyday users. For many, the biggest advantage is awareness. Because hypertension usually has no warning signs, an early alert may prompt users to seek medical help sooner. This can lead to lifestyle changes, such as diet, exercise, or stress management, or medical treatment before serious complications develop. The watch's integration with the health app, users can easily track their trends, log cuff readings, and share data directly with doctors, encouraging a more collaborative approach to care. Limitations and what's next. It's important to note that the watch won't catch every case of hypertension. Its alerts depend on consistent data collection, and confirmation with a cuff is still required. Accessibility to reliable home blood pressure monitors may also pose challenges in some communities. Still, the rollout represents a major step towards preventive health care, and Apple isn't stopping here. Reports suggest the company is already exploring ways to deliver precise blood pressure readings directly from the watch, which could someday eliminate the need for an external cuff altogether. A new role for wearables. The Apple Watch has long tracked activity, heart rate, and even sleep. With the addition of hypertension alerts, it's stepping further into the realm of proactive healthcare. For those at risk, it could serve as an early warning system, and for the broader public, it marks another example of technology bridging the gap between everyday life and life-saving healthcare. As Apple rolls out this new tool, the message is clear. Sometimes the most important alerts aren't texts or emails. They're the ones that may save your life. This article was titled, How Your Apple Watch Could Warn You About High Blood Pressure, by Voice Health News, September 13, 2025. The next article is titled, Teachers Are Suing the Trump Administration Over ICE Arrest, Leading to Kids Dropping Out of School, by Kyra Alessandrini, Blavity, September 14, 2025. Labor unions representing teachers and school employees have filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration over its immigration crackdown. They say arrests are instigating fear and leading to some children dropping out of school. The National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, the two largest teacher unions in the country, allege that immigration arrests at schools are in violation of the law. On Tuesday, they joined a lawsuit that had originally been filed by a group of churches in April in Oregon. They had sued the Trump administration's directives to open houses of worship to ICE officers, according to the Associated Press. Why are ICE officers operating at schools and churches? For decades, ICE agents were told to steer clear of sensitive locations, such as schools, hospitals, and places of worship. In a 2021 memo, the Department of Homeland Security said officers could accomplish its enforcement mission without denying or limiting individuals' access to needed medical care, children's access to their schools, the displaced access to food and shelter, people of faith access to their places of worship. The DHS rescinded the memo shortly after President Trump took office. Instead, ICE agents were told to use common sense when cracking down on immigration near schools and churches. Criminals will no longer be able to hide in America's schools and churches to avoid arrest, officials said, according to the Associated Press. Immigration arrests have started being played out at schools and places of worship. Changes in ICE directives have led to immigration arrests being conducted near and around schools. At an Oregon preschool, agents broke a car window and dragged a student's father from his car after the child had been dropped off, according to the lawsuit. Teachers played music so that students couldn't hear the scene being played out outside. Why a school? Why not someplace else, any place else? Lauren Fong, the teacher of the child whose father was arrested, said. It was in the parking lot, where it could be witnessed by so many young children. In Los Angeles, ICE agents stopped a car parked next to a high school, and they handcuffed a 15-year-old boy with disabilities while at gunpoint as they searched for a man with gang ties. Officers released the boy after finding out they had stopped the wrong person, the lawsuit added. Pennsylvania and Virginia high school teachers said some students stopped showing up to school out of fear of being arrested on campus, according to the lawsuit. A Texas teacher added that there has been a drop in enrollment of students learning English, while a California educator said that children with immigrant parents are no longer being enrolled in special education services. America's classrooms must be safe and welcoming places of learning and discovery. President of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten, said. There has also been a drop in mass attendance, according to church leaders. They allege in the lawsuit that the Trump administration's allowing arrests at churches violates the First Amendment by making parishioners afraid to go to church. The lawsuit adds that it is a violation of the Administrative Procedure Act, which bars federal agents from implementing policies that are arbitrary, capricious, and abuse of discretion, or otherwise not in accordance with the law. This article is titled, Teachers Are Suing the Trump Administration Over ICE Arrests, Leading to Kids Dropping Out of School, by Kyra Alexandrini, Blavity, September 14, 2025. The next article is from The Griot and is titled, Black Directors Who Rose to Prominence Through Robert Redford's Sundance Film Festival, written by Kay Wicker, September 18, 2025. Film icon Robert Redford died Tuesday at the age of 89, but not before leaving a massive legacy in Hollywood and one of the most influential legacies in cinema, the Sundance Film Festival. Founded in the early 1980s through his Sundance Institute, the annual festival began in Utah as a showcase for independent film and has since grown into the premier stage for discovering new talent. Over the decades, Sundance has evolved from a small gathering of indie hopefuls to a global star-studded launchpad that has kick-started the careers of countless directors who would go on to define Hollywood. That list includes some of the biggest names in black filmmaking today, like Barry Jenkins, Ryan Coogler, Ava DuVernay, Dee Reese, and Jordan Peele, and some of their buzziest Sundance premieres like Fruitvale Station, Pariah, Middle of Nowhere, and Get Out. These films not only captivated audiences in Park City, but also went on to shape conversations in Hollywood and beyond. As the world remembers Redford for his work and legacy, we're revisiting some of our favorite black directors who have come through Sundance and changed the face of film forever. Brittany Shine, S-H-Y-N-E. Emerging as part of Sundance's newest wave, Brittany Shine premiered her debut documentary, Seeds, at the 2025 Sundance Film Festival in January, where it won the U.S. Grand Jury Prize for Documentary, supported by the Sundance Institute Documentary Fund. Shine's work reflects the evolving landscape of Black independent film. Nia DaCosta. DaCosta made waves at Sundance in 2018 with Little Woods, a gripping neo-Western about two sisters struggling to survive in North Dakota. The film, developed through the Sundance Institute's Screenwriters and Directors Labs, spotlighted her tense, character-driven storytelling and set her on a path that would lead to writing and directing major studio projects, particularly in horror like Candyman and the upcoming 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple. Jordan Peele. Believe it or not, Peele's directorial debut, Get Out, which won him a rare Oscar in writing and completely invented a new style of horror, premiered at Sundance in 2017. To the surprise of few, the film electrified audiences with its razor-sharp satire on race and horror. Ryan Coogler. Coogler burst onto the scene in 2013 when Fruitvale Station, developed through the Sundance Institute's feature film program, premiered at the festival and swept both the Audience Award and the Grand Jury Prize. The film, based on the real-life killing of Oscar Grant, first introduced Coogler as the socially conscious auteur, churning out blockbusters like Black Panther and Sinners we know today. Ava DuVernay. 2 years before DuVernay exploded onto the scene with her groundbreaking film Selma, she made history at Sundance with the feature Middle of Nowhere. The film debut made her the first Black woman to win Sundance's Best Director Award. Soon after, she joined Sundance Institute Board of Trustees in 2013, helping shape the very organization that had championed her. Dee Rees, R-E-E-S. Rees, who has titles like Mudbound and Bessie under her belt, debuted at Sundance in 2011 with the film Pariah. The intimate film won her the Excellence of Cinematography Award and became a breakout moment. Developed with the support of the Sundance Institute Labs, the film's intimate portrayal of a Black lesbian teenager's coming of age cemented Rees as a vital storyteller about Black life. Barry Jenkins. Before Moonlight won the Oscar, Jenkins brought his lyrical debut, Medicine for Melancholy, to festivals in 2008, and soon after joined the Sundance Institute Screenwriters and Directors Labs in 2010, where he developed what would later become Moonlight. That early Institute support cemented his voice as one to watch, laying the groundwork for his historic Hollywood success. Wendell B. Harris. In 1990, Wendell B. Harris Jr. made history at Sundance when his satirical mockumentary, Chameleon Street, won the Dramatic Grand Jury Prize, making him the first Black director to take home a major award at the festival. His bold debut, written, directed, and starring Harris himself, carved out a path for future Black storytellers to be recognized on indie cinema's biggest stage. This article was titled, Black Directors Who Rose to Prominence Through Robert Redford's Sundance Film Festival, written by Kay Wicker, The Griot, September 18, 2025. Next, an article from Kansas City, The Beacon, titled, Needs of Seniors Shape Plans for Swoop Health's $126 million campus on grounds of shuttered KC nursing home. Written by Mike Sherry, Sherry, September 17, 2025. 6 decades ago, Kansas City architects were already grappling with the housing needs of an aging population at a time when adult children were increasingly unlikely to care for their parents. In the July 1963 issue of its monthly journal, Skylines, the Kansas City chapter of the American Institute of Architects devoted a special section to local senior living projects designed by area firms. The graying of America would continue, the article said. One project of note was the $700,000 expansion of a privately owned facility at 5900 Swoop Parkway, where white jacketed waiters serve dinner, for which wine is a nicety of daily living. Built in 1967, Swoop Ridge Nursing Home eventually expanded further to a licensed capacity of 240 beds and transitioned to the nonprofit Swoop Ridge Geriatric Center. Through the years, Swoop Ridge evolved from a haven for comfortably well-off residents into a financially troubled nursing home serving mostly frail, low-income seniors. Swoop Ridge's closure in 2022 barely made a ripple in the wider community, but it left a hole in the surrounding Town Fork Creek neighborhood. Now, Swoop Health is proposing a $126 million intergenerational development on the former Swoop Ridge property, the largest such endeavor in the safety net provider's nearly 60-year history. Fundraising is ongoing for the 12-acre development, which could take a decade to complete, but Swoop Health has secured about $25 million needed to start the first phase of Swoop Health Village. It held a groundbreaking on August 7th, which included remarks from Kansas City Mayor Pro Tem Rayana Parks Shaw. Swoop Health Village is for the neighbors who said to me when Swoop Ridge was closing, "Now, Councilwoman, what are you going to do about that? We don't want this blighted. We don't want this closed building here. What about those people over there? What about those people in that building?" Parks Shaw said. "And I'm so grateful for the opportunity to be able to say we are here and we are delivering on the promises that we made." The Gray Revolution. The Kansas City architects in 1963 had a clear crystal ball. In 2020, people aged 65 and older comprised 16.8% of the population, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, compared with 9.2% in 1960. In raw numbers, the population of seniors had risen during that period from 16.6 million to 55.8 million. Meanwhile, KFF Health News, a national nonprofit newsroom, reports that about 28% of people 65 and older live alone, including nearly 6 million men and more than 10 million women. Those figures don't include seniors living in institutions, primarily assisted living and nursing homes. And in May, Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies highlighted the dual burden of health care and housing facing U.S. seniors. The study said that one-third of older households experienced housing cost burdens, meaning they spent more than 30% of their income on housing, and that about three-quarters could not afford a single home care visit after paying housing and living costs. As KFF Health News summarized, this gray revolution in America's living arrangements is fueled by longer lifespans, rising rates of divorce and childlessness, smaller family, geographic dispersion of family members, an emphasis on aging in place, and a preference for what Eric Kleinberg, a professor of sociology in New York University, calls intimacy at a distance, being close to family but not too close. Consider the modern residential campus. Swoop Health has planned for Swoop Health Village, one response to the growing housing needs of an aging nation. In addition to 200 units of affordable housing for seniors, Swoop Health's plan includes another 90 units for mental health housing and for participants in its programs of all-inclusive care for the elderly. PACE, KC. Also planned are 10 beds for substance abuse treatment in collaboration with the Kansas City court system. Swoop Health is pursuing the project as a mixed-use purpose-built community that also includes retail space services from the Kansas City Health Department, plus community gardens and a community center. People. We're defining healthcare as a broader umbrella, said Swoop Health CEO Jeron Ravin, Jeron Ravin. For instance, he said, in accordance with the purpose-built community pillar of economic vitality, Swoop Health envisions space on that campus where community-based organizations offer classes on topics like banking and financial literacy. Swoop Health Village might also be a venue to train aspiring chefs and other entrepreneurs, while also having space to introduce students to healthcare careers. Swoop Health Village is part of a nationwide trend, said Sonia Bacchus, B-A-C-H-U-S, Chief Experience Officer for the National Association of Community Health Centers. She attended the groundbreaking. She said health centers like Swoop Health are embracing the concept of providing care from birth onward and recognizing that circumstances outside the exam room, such as quality, affordable housing, impact health. When we look at working to keep people as fully functioning in their own space as long as possible, this type of development is how that happens, as opposed to people having to move their loved ones into a full-service nursing home earlier on, Bacca said. I think there's a lot more opportunity for longer autonomy for seniors when they have this kind of infrastructure. Ravin credited staff and leadership at Swoop Ridge for doing all they could for as long as they could, but insufficient Medicaid reimbursements and an aging structure meant the facility could no longer provide quality care, even as staff size and available usable space reduced occupancy to around 80 residents when Swoop Ridge officials decided to phase out operations as alternative accommodations could be secured. Swoop Health needed to step up, Ravin said. For Swoop Ridge to no longer exist and not have any type of replacement services would have been a significant disservice to the community, Ravin said. Initial support for Swoop Health Village has included $12.5 million in city and state funding. Ravin and Swoop Health will continue to pursue public funding for future phases, and he hopes the philanthropic community will contribute as well. Losing an anchor. Not long after the 1963 Skylines article, a five-page McGraw-Hill publication featured Swoop Ridge as its nursing home of the month. The spread highlighted the physical therapy program that owner Albert G. Incani, I-N-C-A-N-I, had instituted and noted various resident committees like the one that published the bi-monthly Guys and Dolls newsletter, which had a circulation of about 1,000 readers, including residents, their families, physicians, and clergy. As late as 1997, the Kansas City magazine, Ingram's, headlined its story about Swoop Ridge as the miracle in Midtown for continuing to provide top-notch care, even as suburbanization had transitioned its residents to a lower-income population. That's the neighborhood anchor, remembered by Lisa Ray, R-A-Y, 57, president of the Town Fork Creek Neighborhood Association, delivering soap, lotion, deodorant, and other sundries to the residents as part of Central Supply. Swoop Ridge, she knew then, was a nice place where middle-class minorities from nearby areas could stay in familiar surroundings once they were unable to live on their own. Swoop Ridge's closure not only left a void for seniors in the community, Ray said, but it also eliminated jobs within walking distance for area workers. She now sees some of the workers walking to Prospect Avenue, about a dozen blocks west, to take a bus to their jobs. As one of the people ending Parks Shaw's ear about the fate of the Swoop Ridge site, Ray is cautiously optimistic about Swoop Health Village. She said residents will be inclined to support Swoop Health because of its long service to the community. That being said, she wants to ensure that, like Swoop Ridge, the senior housing serves seniors in and around Town Fork Creek. Given the cost of new construction, Ray also wondered how developers can keep the units within the price range of the intended population. Parking and traffic are also concerns, given the multi-purpose uses envisioned for Swoop Health Village. I don't think residents are going to be used to so much busyness going on in the area, Ray said. But if there's anyone who knows the value of letting seniors stay close to home as they age, it's Ray. Her 97-year-old grandmother, Elizabeth Ray, was a Swoop Ridge resident when it closed. Elizabeth Ray was a cook in the Kansas City School District for 40 years. She worked primarily at the old Crispus Attucks Elementary School, but was also a trainer in other buildings. Elizabeth Ray was a take-no-mercy poker player who didn't even let up on kids. She was a pistol, Lisa Ray said. She lived life to the fullest. When Swoop Ridge closed, Elizabeth Ray moved in with her daughter, who was in her 70s at the time. So it was hard for her to take care of an immobile elderly woman. The family relocated Elizabeth Ray to a nursing home on Southwest Traffic Way. She died a couple years later, and Lisa Ray said the disruption of moving out of Swoop Ridge was probably a contributing factor. Seniors don't like change, she said. And most of the time, when you move seniors, it does something to them. It does. This article was titled, Needs of Seniors Shape Plans for Swoop Health's $126 million campus on grounds of shuttered KC Nursing Home by Mike Sherry, The Beacon, Kansas City, September 17, 2025. The next article is from The Voice and is titled, UNICEF Childhood Obesity Surpasses Underweight Worldwide, written by Bonita Gooch, September 16, 2025. UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell called the findings a wake-up call. When we talk about malnutrition, we are no longer just talking about underweight children, she said. Ultra-processed food is increasingly replacing fruits, vegetables, and protein at a time when nutrition plays a critical role in children's growth, cognitive development, and mental health.
Obesity places children at risk of insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, and even cancer. Experts note that unhealthy diets, heavy in processed foods and sugary drinks, are driving the problem worldwide. Economic patterns also influence obesity. In high-income countries, overweight is more common among children in low-income households, while in low-income countries, wealthier families are more likely to have overweight children. In middle-income nations, the trend spans all income groups. While underweight rates among children 5 to 19 have declined with 13% in 2000 to 9.2% today, undernutrition among children under 5 remains a serious concern in many poorer nations. This article was titled, UNICEF Childhood Obesity Surpasses Underweight Worldwide, by Bonita Gooch, The Voice, September 16, 2025. Key takeaways. Childhood obesity has doubled in 25 years, now topping 188 million cases. Obesity exceeds underweight in nearly every region but Africa and South Asia. Ultra-processed foods are fueling the crisis, replacing healthy meals. More children and adolescents around the globe are now obese than underweight, according to a new report from UNICEF. The agency estimates that 188 million young people are obese, marking a dramatic shift in child nutrition patterns over the past 25 years. Researchers analyzed data from more than 190 countries and found that the number of overweight children ages 5 to 19 has doubled since 2000, rising from 194 million to 391 million. A significant share of those are classified as obese. Obesity is now more common than underweight in every region of the world, except sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. The highest prevalence is found in several Pacific Island nations, including Niue, 38%, the Cook Islands, 37%, and Niue, 38%. The Cook Islands, high-income nations, also report alarming rates. 27% of 5 to 19-year-olds in Chile and 21% in both the United States. The next article is from Blavity and is titled, The Summer I Turned Pretty Movie. Here's Everything We Know So Far, written by Trey Mangum, M-A-N-G-U-M, September 18th, 2025. Shortly after The Summer I Turned Pretty series finale, Amazon Studios announced that the franchise wasn't ending just yet. To conclude the story, Prime Video has set a feature film to wrap everything up. Written and directed by Jenny Han, H-A-N, the plot details of the film are under wraps, but the news was confirmed at Thursday night's red carpet celebration for the series finale in Paris. The Summer I Turned Pretty has struck a chord with audiences everywhere, creating moments of joy, nostalgia, and connection that have made it a global sensation, said Courtney Valenti, V-A-L-E-N-T-I, head of film streaming and theatrical at Amazon MGM Studios, and Vernon Sanders, global head of television at Prime Video and Amazon MGM Studios. We're proud of the series' extraordinary success and couldn't be more excited to partner again with Jenny Han to bring fans an unforgettable chapter. Jenny Han says another big milestone left in Belly's journey. There's another big milestone left in Belly's journey, and I thought only a movie could give it its proper due. I'm so grateful to Prime Video for continuing to support my vision for this story and for making it possible to share this final chapter with the fans, said Han. Season 3 of the show nabbed 25 million viewers globally in its first 17 days, per Prime Video. Season 3 of the show nabbed 25 million viewers globally in its first 7 days, per Prime Video, and is their fifth most watched returning season. Season 1, which premiered in 2022, was the number one show on Prime Video in its first weekend, and Season 2, which was in 2023, doubled that viewership in 3 days. Per its official description, based on the best-selling book trilogy from Han, The Summer I Turned Pretty is a multi-generational drama centered around a love triangle involving one girl and two brothers. It explores the complex bonds between mothers and their children, the strength of lasting female friendships, and the transformative journey of growing up. At its heart, it's a coming-of-age tale about first love, first heartbreak, and the unforgettable magic of one perfect summer. Han and Sarah Kuserka, Kuserka, were the showrunners for Season 3 and executive produced alongside Karen Rosenfeld, as well as Paul Lee, Hope Hartman, and Mads Hansen of WIIP. The series is co-produced by Amazon MGM Studios and WIIP. This article was titled, The Summer I Turned Pretty Movie. Here's Everything We Know So Far, written by Trey Mangum, Blavity, September 18th, 2025. Next, an article from News One titled, 10-year-old farmer makes history with full-ride HBCU scholarship, written by Joe Jurado, August 21st, 2025. In some much-needed good news, 10-year-old Kendall Ray Johnson made history after receiving a full-ride scholarship to HBCU South Carolina State University for Agriculture. According to 11 Alive News, Kendall Ray Johnson's full-ride scholarship is traditionally reserved for athletes. Johnson caught the attention of South Carolina State University President Alexander Conyers after becoming the youngest certified farmer in the United States at the age of 6. Conyers told Johnson's family that if he's able to award scholarships to athletes, he should be able to do so for an ag scholar. Johnson's scholarship will cover her tuition, fees, room, and board. I'm the first 10-year-old to get a full-ride scholarship, Johnson told 11 Alive. Johnson's ultimate goal is to have a 100-acre farm with cattle, chickens, and various other farm animals. Johnson currently lives in South Fulton, Georgia, with her parents. She's taken the lead on her family's farm, helping her parents their livestock and crops. It's living with the ceiling open, Johnson's mother Ursula said. We have no idea where we're going, but we're just following. Agriculture is the number one industry in Georgia, so Johnson already has a strong handle on a skill set that will prove lucrative as she grows older. She just wanted to grow, Ursula told 11 Alive. Once she found her love of growing, that blossomed into what you see today. As a USDA National Urban Agriculture Youth Ambassador, Johnson also encourages children across the country to experience the joy of farming. I want to tell them to keep growing, keep going, keep being amazing. You do you, Kendall Ray Johnson said. She also encourages any young farmers to apply for USDA Youth Farming Scholarships, which is how she received her full-ride scholarship to South Carolina State University. The topic of Black farmers has been bizarrely controversial in recent years. While there were nearly 1 million Black farmers in the 1920s, a century later, that number has been whittled down to only 45,508. A program to cancel debt for Black farmers was met with legal pushback from white farmers because they felt it was racist against them. Under the Biden administration, the USDA established a grant intended to address historical faced by Black farmers. However, earlier this year, the USDA quickly walked back several programs intended to address those disparities. Those reversals have made Black farmers particularly vulnerable to the impact the Trump administration tariffs had on agriculture. With that context, it's even more heartening to see Kendall Ray Johnson continue the proud legacy of Black farmers. Hopefully, her example inspires more young Black farmers to let their green thumbs shine. This article was titled, 10-Year-Old Farmer Makes History with Full Ride HBCU Scholarship, written by Joe Giurado, News 1, August 21st, 2025. The next article is from Andscape, and it's titled, A Resurgent Texas A&M Makes Unity Seem Possible, by Jesse Washington, September 18, 2025. College Station, Texas. The Cannon denotation sends a tremor through your chest. The student section, 30,000 deep, is a boiling mass of maroon and white, led by five young men wearing denim overalls, embroidered with symbols of common faith. The crowd fills the stadium with yells, declarations, and whoops that are a language of devotion all its own. And this is just the rehearsal. Kickoff is 12 hours away. Welcome to Midnight Yell, where Texas A&M Aggies gather the night before football games. It's one of the most famous traditions in college football, which is a sport steeped in more traditions than any other. I've come to College Station to begin an exploration of the culture of the game, the beliefs and values, rites and rituals, and ways of life that makes college football the most American sport of them all. What does it mean in these divisive times to be American? Definitions vary by what team we represent, but certain ideals remain prevalent. We value hard physical work, on the playing field or the factory floor. We believe in the literal pursuit of happiness. We run to the daylight of opportunities by wagon train or NIL-funded Dodge Charger. When things look bleak on fourth and long, we trust that progress is possible. And above all, America is a nation of many, with ethnicities from across the globe still figuring out how to win as one. College football is more diverse and more watched than the NBA, MLB, hockey, or soccer. The size of its audience trails only pro footballs. But while the NFL is played exclusively in major cities and games have a similar feel from stadium to stadium, college football Saturdays happen in places large and small, urban and rural, bringing out the entire breadth of the nation. College football's scars, exploitation, greed, legacies of racism also reflect American culture. Each game is a strand in the American tapestry. That's why I came to College Station on the first weekend in September, a few days ahead of Texas A&M's 44-22 ritual sacrifice of Utah State, and a week before its 41-40 stunner over Notre Dame. If there is one place that best exemplifies college football's mix of tradition, race, myth, money, and the overwhelming hunger for victory, it's Aggieland, and nothing is more Aggie than Midnight Yell. First, some things to know about Texas A&M. It's huge. Enrollment is more than 79,000, second most of any college in America after Arizona State. It's a player contender. The number 10 Aggies secured their biggest win in years on September 13th with a last-second touchdown at Notre Dame. Under second-year coach Mike Elko, E-L-K-O, A&M has its first road win against an AP top 10 opponent since 2014 and is moving past the disastrous Jimbo Fisher regime. Former Aggies in the NFL include the Browns' Miles Garrett, the Ravens' Nnamdi Madubuike, N-N-A-M-D-I, M-A-D-U-B-U-I-K-E, and the Bucks' Mike Evans, plus Lions' head coach Dan Campbell, and Jets' head coach Aaron Glenn. You might have heard of Johnny Manziel, M-A-N-Z-I-E-L. It's not that other Texas school Aggies refer to the University of Texas as TU, lowercase. Their hated rival, located in liberal Austin, has a highfalutin reputation compared with blue-collar A&M, which stands for Agriculture and Mechanical, and boasts a meat science department. Aggies have good reason to feel slighted. The Texas State Constitution still mandates that 2/3 of all permanent university fund revenue go to the Austin school, compared to 1/3 for A&M. It's one of the most conservative colleges in the nation, which is a proud quote from Texas A&M itself. Political pressure led an A&M professor being fired on September 9th in 2023. The same dynamic sank the appointment of a black woman to run the journalism department. Its student body is 3.75% black and 25% Hispanic. Its football team, by my eye test, is more than 60% black. These are the ingredients of Midnight Yell. It begins with the 5 Yell leaders elected by their fellow students, leading the marching band and the collie mascot, Reveal X, who has her own golf cart, cell phone, and 170,000 Instagram followers, into the enormous Kyle Field. Two of the YLs then pace the field in a routine that dates back to the large feet of a cadet named Peanut. The 5 crew cut cadets wear overalls with creases ironed into the legs and sewn with a variety of phrases, symbols, and patches, including an A and M on the left and right butt cheek, respectively. After the students arrive, junior cadets have the privilege of gathering on the field level, just beneath the spectators' area, with freshmen, sophomores, and seniors in the stands. In a flip of the normal pecking order, juniors are run through calisthenics by underclassmen. Like many Aggie traditions from the outside, these human pyramids and barrel rolls might seem silly, but they connect to a deeper meaning. In this case, the A&M tradition of selfless service, regardless of rank or station. The fun continues with actual yells. There are no gymnastics. Aggies don't cheer, they yell, led through an elaborate vocabulary and movements led by the yell leaders. The internet likes to mock the YLs, but as I watched and listened, their custom reminded me of other Americana. The elaborate handshakes created between friends, the call and response of black fraternities and sororities, the slang my kids use that I'm not supposed to understand. We want to embody our core values of respect, excellence, leadership, loyalty, integrity, and selfless service, said the head Yale leader, Kyle Fife, when I spoke to him before the event. Everything that we do, it's not just about football. It brings the whole community together. The unity includes players when they're on the field. I definitely feel a crazy connection, the defense end, Cassius Howell, C-A-S-H-I-U-S, who tallied 3 consecutive sacks against Utah State. As I'm making plays, I just feel the energy, you know, from the 12th man and the fans. And I feel like I pick back up off their energy. It allows me to have a better chance at making more plays, kind of like a positive domino effect. Fife, F-I-F-E, born and raised in Odessa, Texas, was student body president at the Permian High, the school chronicled in the book Friday Night Lights. During our interview, he wore a khaki cadet uniform and the high leather boots, complete with spurs and gold-stamped insignia, worn by seniors. The boots cost $2,500. Cadets make their first payment as freshmen. At games, the Yale leaders wear white coveralls, a tradition that goes back about a century. In the NFL, it's a lot of politics. It's players getting paid hundreds of millions of dollars, Fife said. College football is like kids I grew up with in Texas. It's the people who are brought into their community and their culture. When you pack 115,000 people in Kyle Field, black, white, it doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter what your story is, how you got there, he said. In that moment, you're all Aggies. That's the American story, too. This was part one of the article titled, A Resurgent Texas A&M Makes Unity Seem Possible, by Jesse Washington and Scape, September 18th, 2025. We will continue with part two in the next series. It's all the time we have for the African American Hour. My name is Rosemary Onkwe. Thanks for joining me.